Shalom. Welcome to ASJTF. This is Chaim Ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to a refuah shlema, complete recovery, for David Eliyahu Chai Ben Nina Miriam Chaya, and Avraham Ben Batsheva, and Claire Weissman, and also to elevate the souls of Simcha Chazdai, Pesach Ben Dov, Meir Ben Yecheskel, and Yosef Ben Meir. Before we get to our many questions from our great JTFers, I'm actually going to take a question that was asked by one of our great JTFers, and I'm going to make that the opening subject of the program this week, because I think the question is worthy this particular week of turning it into the opening subject. And that question comes from the great Kahana loyalist, who writes, and I quote, "Dear Chaim, could we hear a Rabbi Kahana Zatzal story?" Unquote. Okay, that's what we're going to open the program with. In June of 1973, Soviet Nazi dictator Leonid Brezhnev, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro, was planning to visit the United States. And this was a very important time in terms of the history of Soviet-American relations, because the Soviets desperately wanted better relations with the United States. Their economy was in very bad shape. They desperately needed American technology, American computers, American food shipments, American wheat. They literally would have been starving without Western food. So they desperately needed relations with the United States, good relations with the United States and the Western world, but especially with the United States. And so they had a policy called détente, where the Soviets and the Americans had a relationship, had improving relations, and it was a one-sided street. It was really pathetic. I mean, the United States was basically propping up the Soviet Union. And this policy was initiated under President Nixon and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro, the self-hating Jewish traitor. And this policy basically enabled the Soviets to continue. They gave the Soviets all types of food shipments, technology transfers, so-called arms control agreements, where the Soviets cheated on all the arms control agreements. The Soviet regime was being artificially propped up and kept alive by this policy of détente, which was a policy of appeasement. And so in June of 1973, the Soviets were planning to have their dictator, the Soviet leader at the time, Leonid Brezhnev, visit America. And it was a very crucial time for Soviet Jewry, because we just had started a campaign with the Jewish Defense League in 1969 to free Soviet Jewry. And for the first time since the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, for the first time in 52 years, thousands of Soviet Jews were being allowed to leave the Soviet Union and go to Israel. But there still were 2 million Jews trapped as prisoners behind the Iron Curtain and were not being allowed to leave. And so the JDL strategy of Rabbi Meir Kahana Zatzal was to tie Soviet-American relations and say, if you want a relationship with the United States, tell the Soviet leaders, if you want a relationship with the United States, which you so desperately need, the condition is going to be, at least the condition that we're imposing is going to be, that you must free all Soviet Jews. You must allow all Soviet Jews to leave. Now, of course, we felt that the whole idea of a better Soviet-American relationship was a disaster, and that the whole idea of détente was bad. But we said, if the United States is going to do this crazy thing, at the very least, we demand that as a precondition, all Soviet Jews be permitted to leave the Soviet Union. And the JDL had a campaign to do this, and tens of thousands of Jews were getting out in the 1970s because of this. The vast majority of Jews were still being held hostage, but for the first time, tens of thousands were being released. Before then, at the most, a few hundred Jews would be released every year, and most of them were elderly Jews. So it was, I mean, basically you had, the Jews were held prisoner, and Jews were just not allowed to leave for 52 years until the JDL started its campaign. It was the JDL campaign that opened the doors for the first time to freeing Soviet Jewry. Anyway, in June of 1973, before the June 1973 visit, Rabbi Meir Kahana was in Israel already, and he was trapped in Israel. He was being held hostage. The Israeli government took his passport away and said, you can't travel to the United States, because Nixon and Kissinger asked the traitor Golda Meir, who was then the prime minister, the defense minister, Moshe Dayan, all traitors, Abba Ibn at that time was the foreign minister, and the United States, the Nixon-Kissinger administration said, look, Rabbi Kahane and the JDL are hurting Soviet-American relations. Their campaign is complicating the detente that we want with the Soviets. You've got to prevent him from coming to the United States, because he's going to lead all types of violent protests and all types of demonstrations, protests, and maybe even bombings that will severely complicate our attempts to improve relations with the Soviet Union. And so the Israeli government, as usual, caved in immediately, gave in immediately to what the United States demanded, as usual. And they seized Rabbi Kahane's passport and said, you can't travel to the United States, even though he had dual citizenship. He was born in the United States, so he was an American citizen and an Israeli citizen. So the Americans from the United States could not stop him from entering. But the Israeli government, which operates many times like a Bolshevik dictatorship, did stop him. They took his passport away and said, you can't leave the country. All right. So he, Rabbi Kahane, was very concerned because the JDL had collapsed. The Jewish Defense League, the JDL, the organization that he put together, had collapsed since he made Aliyah. From the time when he made Aliyah in 1971, the JDL was moving down. I mean, really was falling apart without his presence here. And there was no real JDL to protest or to do anything effective to make sure that Brezhnev's visit would not be a success, because the purpose of the JDL strategy was to make sure that the Soviets would never succeed in truly improving relations with the United States, that this constant problem would come up of their refusal to let the Soviet Jews go, that this would be a constant problem for them until they finally would be forced to let the Soviet Jews go. That was the JDL strategy. They would have to remove that obstacle if they were going to have any hope of better relations with the United States. This was the JDL strategy. And that meant that the Brezhnev visit had to be disrupted, or there had to be serious problems during this visit. If the Brezhnev visit went smoothly and everything went well, the Soviets would see that the JDL is no longer a threat, that the JDL basically has fallen apart now that Rabbi Kahane is in Israel, and they no longer have anything to worry about, and they don't have to let any Soviet Jews go anymore. That was the great danger of the Brezhnev visit. But the Brezhnev visit also was a great opportunity, because if the JDL or good Jews were able to do disruptive things that would cause problems for Soviet-American relations, that would lead to even more Soviet Jews getting out. So that was so there was both a danger from this visit and an opportunity. Rabbi Kahane wrote letters to several people in the United States, and he urged them to kidnap Soviet diplomats, and demand freedom for Soviet Jews that were being held in Siberia, in Siberian concentration camps. Now, that never happened, and the FBI got a hold of one of these letters that Rabbi Kahane sent, and eventually he was on probation at the time when he wrote these letters, so eventually his probation was violated. You know, he came back to the United States, and they eventually wanted to put him back in prison because of the letters. But in any event, and Rabbi Kahane phrased the letters in a way where it would not actually be, they couldn't actually charge him with a crime, because he said it would be great if people kidnap Soviet diplomats. He didn't say, you go and kidnap Soviet diplomats. He phrased it in a way, Rabbi Kahane was very, very clever, and he phrased it in a way where they couldn't actually charge him, they couldn't actually indict him. But because he was on probation at the time, he wasn't allowed probation. You can have your probation revoked, and you can be put back in prison when you're on probation, even for doing things that are technically not crimes, even for doing things that are technically legal. You have conditions of probation that go beyond just obeying the law. And he violated his probation by writing those letters. In any event, we saw how urgent Rabbi Kahane was writing. He had a weekly column in the Jewish press, which at that time was a big newspaper. Now it's a joke. Now it's a farce. But he made it into a big newspaper, Rabbi Kahane, because his columns were so great in the Jewish press. There were such fantastic columns. And He was writing urgently week after week, and he wrote these letters to people in the JDL about kidnapping Soviet diplomats. And he was basically sounding the alarm that this is urgent, that we've got to act now, otherwise Soviet Jews are going to be crushed. The Soviet Jewry movement will be crushed, and Soviet Jews will face terrible tragedy if the Soviets see they could get away with this, and that they could have smooth relations with the United States, even though they're oppressing and persecuting and holding Soviet Jews hostage. If they see they can do this, if the Soviets see they can do this, they're going to do it. So he was urgently pleading with people to take action now. And he couldn't come to the United States. His passport was seized, so... You know, he was basically hoping that someone else would do it. Well, no one else was willing to do anything about it, and they were not willing to hear the rabbi's pleas about this historic opportunity, except for two young Jews, two teenagers who decided on their own to go out and do something. One was a Jewish hero named Zelig Spern, Zichrono Livracha, Alav HaShalom, and I say that because that means his memory should be blessed, because unfortunately, about a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, Zelig Spern passed away. He died of a heart attack. But anyway, at that time, Zelig Spern was 18 years old, and he was one of these Jews. And the second Jew was Chaim Ben Pesach, myself. I was 16 years old at the time. And the two of us decided that we're going to take action. We're going to do something. And so we went down to the suburbs of Washington, D.C., Maryland. We knew where the Soviet diplomats were living. They were living in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., the Soviet diplomats that were attached to the Soviet embassy in Washington. And we bombed two of their cars. We blew up two of their cars and destroyed two of their cars in Maryland. And then, in another incident, a week or two later, I don't remember exactly, but it was a week or two later, we then bombed another Soviet diplomat's car in the Far Rockaway section of Queens. So we destroyed three Soviet diplomats' cars. This was done in the middle of the night. No one was injured. But it was done 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. But, you know, there was a big blast. And when the Soviets came out, they saw that their cars were destroyed. This, and then, of course, we called the news media anonymously and took responsibility and said and mentioned and made it clear that this was being done because of the persecution of Soviet Jews. This made the issue of Soviet Jewry, the bombings and blowing up of these three cars, Soviet diplomats' cars, made the issue of Soviet Jewry a central focus, a central issue during Brezhnev's visit to the United States, when he met with President Nixon and Secretary Kissinger and members of Congress and all the other things that happened during his visit. This issue became a dominant issue, a major obstacle in Soviet-American relations. The issue did not go away, and it actually became more severe because of these bombings. Soviet-American relations were damaged by these bombings. So the Soviets clearly got the message that they have a problem, that they have a serious problem that they have to overcome if they really want smooth Soviet-American relations, because the visit did not go as smoothly as they were hoping. Because of these bombings, you can't have a very smooth visit when the cars of your diplomats are being blown up, and a big issue is being raised against you on the visit that acts like a shadow over the visit that's clouding the whole atmosphere. So, you know, this did have the necessary effect that Rabbi Kahana was hoping for. It wasn't as big as kidnapping Soviet diplomats. Kidnapping Soviet diplomats would have been a lot bigger. But it also would have been the risk of, you get life imprisonment for kidnapping. So that would have been much riskier. And we were two teenage kids. We weren't capable of carrying out something as sophisticated as a kidnapping. But we did know how to blow up cars. That we were able to do. And I remember how Rabbi Kahana was so relieved and so happy when these incidents happened, when those cars were blown up. He was so relieved. And he was so happy because Rabbi Kahana loved the Jewish people. Even though the Jewish people did some terrible things to him, he loved his fellow Jews. He loved the Jewish people with all his heart and all his soul. He was a true rabbi in every sense of the word, willing to give his life, which in the end he did, for the Jewish people. He was willing to give and sacrifice anything if it was good for the Jewish people. Rabbi Kahana never thought of what was good for Rabbi Kahana. He always thought of what was good for the Jewish people and sacrificed his own self-interests over and over again for the good of the Jewish people. That was our leader, Rabbi Meir Kahana. And he inspired two teenage Jewish kids who came from middle-class Jewish backgrounds in the United States to go out and do these things in order to save Soviet Jewry. And the result was that year, in 1973, for the first time, 33,000 Jews were released from the Soviet Union. And the next year, in 1974, immigration continued and continued throughout the 70s because of incidents like this. So tens of thousands of Jews got out. It was 33 or 34,000. It was definitely at least 33,000. 33 or 34,000 Jews got out in 1973 because of this incident. And then eventually other incidents in the 70s continued. And many Jews were saved because of that. Many Jews were saved. If only the Jewish people had listened to Rabbi Kahana, all the Jews in the Soviet Union could have been saved much sooner. And the Jewish people would be much stronger and better for it. But they didn't. He always had the few that would really listen to him and take him seriously and understand the wisdom and the greatness in what he was saying. But thanks to Rabbi Kahana, Soviet Jews were a big issue. And no one could ignore what they were doing to our brothers and sisters behind the Iron Curtain, even though the other Jewish leaders had betrayed Soviet Jewry, just as they betrayed 6 million Jews during the Holocaust. But thankfully, unlike during the Holocaust, we finally had a Jewish leader, Rabbi Kahana, who was standing up the way a Jewish leader is supposed to. Anyway, that's our Rabbi Kahana story for this week. And nowadays, of course, bombing and doing the type of things we did in the JDL would not be effective. This was a different era, different period of time. In the post-9/11 era, it would actually be disastrous for people to go out and do these types of activities. They could be disastrous. So we are a completely law-abiding organization. JTF is completely law-abiding. JTF does not break any laws, and neither in the United States or in Israel. But what we're doing is just as essential as it always was, as the Kahanist message and the Kahanist movement always was. Our movement is essential. What we're warning people about, what we're trying to get people to understand, and how we're trying to wake people up is as important, not only for the Jewish people, but for the whole world, as it always has been. If people would wake up and listen, just think about it. Just think about this. Imagine if we succeed in waking the Jewish people up. Imagine if we succeed in waking up just a large segment of the Jewish people. Imagine how that can change the world. That's what we're trying to do. That's what we're working on doing day and night. That's why we want to reach people with our message. And thank God that our fellow JTFers understand the unbelievable importance of that there's nothing more important in the world than that. Our fellow JTFers at least understand that. And of course, we also want to wake up righteous Gentiles and want to wake people up in the United States. And so we need people in JTF to be as active as possible and helpful as possible. We need your help. We need it now more than ever. When we have Hebrew and English videos, help us promote those videos on YouTube and on Facebook. That means liking, favoriting, commenting, mirror the videos, share the videos on Facebook. Do everything you can on Facebook and on YouTube to promote those videos. Very, very important, in Hebrew and in English. And by the way, when there are Hebrew videos, even if you don't understand the Hebrew, so you don't understand it, but you know that if you like and favorite and comment, and you know at least that you're promoting the videos in the search engines when you do that. So it's important. And we need people to post good posts and good threads on our forums and be active on our forums so that our forums will be places where people will learn things and will be enlightened and where more people will join and become active with us, and it'll be an inviting place for people to want to be motivated and inspired to be active with us. Very important to post good things on our forums and be active on the forums and on our Facebook pages. Very, very important. And finally, of course, last but not least, most importantly, we need financial support. That really will enable us to reach more people. The more financial support we get, the more people we can reach, the more successful we can be in bringing this message to Jews and righteous Gentiles. And so we need people, of course, to help us as they do every week. God bless the wonderful, as people do on a regular basis. We have JTFers who generously help us, who generously send checks and money orders and cash donations through the regular mail to our post office box. God bless the great JTFers who are doing it. We need your help now more than ever. Every donation makes a big difference. And the great JTFers who help us online with their credit cards. Some people prefer to do it online with their credit cards, which is very easy to do. People can just go to the JTF.org main page, or they could go to Hayamin.org main page, the English main page or the Hebrew main page, doesn't make a difference. And there's a donate button on top, and they can donate in a couple of minutes, very conveniently with their credit card, to our movement. God bless the great JTFers who are doing that. We need your help. God bless those of you that are helping us and that are participating in this very important movement, this historic movement. God bless you. God bless your families and your loved ones in this world and in the next. And let's hope that Hashem Yitbarach, that God, blessed be He, give us the strength to make a difference and to save as many people as we can and to turn the situation around as quickly as we can. Be'ezrat Hashem, God willing. All right, that's the opening for this week. And now we go to our questions from our great JTFers. And we start off with the great Pyramid Head fan who writes, and I quote, Dear Chaim, has Hollywood always been immoral even during the silent film era? Unquote. No, Hollywood was actually very careful about what they put on screen during the 1920s, 1930s. Silent film period would be the 1920s. But during the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, they were much more careful about what they put on screen. They themselves were immoral. The actors, the actresses, the directors, the producers, the owners of the Hollywood corporations that bring films to the public, they were always very immoral. The vast majority of them were very immoral, evil people. Always. Since the beginning of Hollywood. The vast majority. There were exceptions, but most were very immoral always. But they couldn't get away with it. They would try as much as possible to push the envelope and to try to get away with as much as they could. And they always tried to do that. And so little by little, you see more and more of immoral themes being introduced into films in the 40s and then in the 50s a little more. And then in the 60s, much more. The 60s, it really started much more. And then, of course, now today, for a long time now, for years now, Hollywood is pure filth. Pure filth and evil. But they had to watch themselves much more carefully because the world or the people were much more moral in the old days. And so they had to be much more careful years ago. Anyway, thank you, Pyramid Head fan. And now we go to our good friend Binyamin Yisrael, who writes, and I quote, You said Jews should have universities in Judea and Samaria, not Manhattan. So what do you think of Ariel University in Samaria, unquote? Well, I'm glad that there's a university there. I'm glad that there's a university in the liberated lands. The university itself is much too establishment for my taste. I mean, you know, they learn things. It's very establishment, very much of an establishment type place. You know, the teachers and the students are, they walk the establishment line. But in general, I'm glad that there is a university there, and I certainly wish that there would be more. I wish there'd be universities and yeshivot where they would teach the Kahanist ideology. Then the Jewish people would be in much better shape. But I am glad at least that there's a university there, and certainly attempts to boycott that university by 6 self-hating Jews are disgusting. Anyway, thank you, Binyamin Yisrael. And now we go to the great Da Vinci, who writes, and I quote, "What is your take on genetically modified food, good or bad for health, respectively, environment?" Unquote. I'm not an expert on genetically modified food. I'm not an expert on the subject. Maybe there are times when it's beneficial, but I just don't trust. I don't trust these types of things. I really think that what God gave us, most of the things that God gave us in their natural form, are probably the best for us. So I don't trust these people that are modifying foods. I don't know. Let's put it this way. I do believe in modern science. I do believe that God gave us a world with a lot of wonderful, beautiful things, but things that we can improve upon and correct. That's one of the challenges that God gave us in life. That's one of the, you know, we're supposed to, tikkun olam, correction of the world. That's one of the reasons we're in this world. If God gave us a perfect world, there'd be nothing for us to do here. The whole purpose and challenge is for us to try to make this a better world, to try to perfect and correct the world that God gave us. And God deliberately created a situation where we have challenges like this, deliberately. So it's possible that science can improve upon foods by genetic modification, maybe. But I'm very skeptical, and I just, in most cases, I don't trust industries and governments to do the good thing for us when it comes to something like this. I'm very skeptical. Anyway, thank you, Da Vinci. And now we go to the great Obama is trash, who writes, and I quote, "Chaim, please help. My brother tells me and everyone that Tsar Naev, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, Tsar Naev, the terrorist, was framed and 9/11 was an inside job. When I say it was Muslims, he calls me racist," unquote. Wow. Wow, your brother has to be so pro-Muslim? They would cut his throat in 2 seconds. They despise him. What is he, crazy? They despise him. They would kill him and every Jew and every non-Muslim in 2 seconds. Supporting Muslims is racist. Defending Muslims, that's racist. That's Nazism. The Muslims have a Nazi ideology of murdering anyone who's a non-Muslim infidel. That's Nazism. That's a Nazi-style ideology. That's similar to what the Nazis wanted to do. Anyone who's not a Muslim, they want to slaughter? Okay, with the Muslims, it's not based on race, but it's based on religion. If you don't believe in their crazy religion, they want to murder you. And your brother defends them? And when they go out and commit terrorist acts that everybody knows they've committed, he says they were framed? And 9/11 was an inside job. What an absurdity. What sick. I mean, how sick. I don't know what to say. Because this is so sick, it's beyond words. I don't know what to say in a situation like that. But your brother better change. Because what he's saying is very evil and very immoral. He's got to change. He had better change and better wake up fast. And because the people he's defending and the crazy theories he's promoting are promoted by people who would cut his throat and cut the throats of everybody he loves and cares about in 2 seconds. They despise him. So he better wake up and wake up fast. Anyway, thank you, Obama's trash. And now we go to our friend Chicago Jew, who writes, and I quote, "Do you know Bob Unger, and what is your opinion of him?" Unquote. Yes, I do know Bob Unger. I have the privilege and the honor of knowing Bob Unger, and I think he's a wonderful person, a wonderful human being, and a wonderful Jew. I think very highly of Bob Unger. He's a very, very good person. Thank you, Chicago Jew. And now we go to the great super Zionist, who writes, and I quote, "Will Barack Hussein Obama finally come to his senses and apologize to the Muslims and build a victory mosque at the site of the Boston explosions?" Unquote. Well, you know, super Zionist, as absurd as what you're writing sounds, it's not absurd, because super Zionist, this is really what America does and what the Western world does every time the Muslims attack. This is what's going to happen. I don't know if they'll build a victory mosque, but they're going to do something else to again appease the Muslims. That's what happens. That is the appeasement mode that America, Israel, and the Western world are perpetually in. They're perpetually in an appeasement mode. They're constantly on their hands and knees before the Muslims. And the fact is they are building a victory mosque at the site of 9/11, where 3,000 Americans were murdered by Muslims. And not only building a victory mosque, they're continuing to give trillions of petrodollars to the Saudis and to other Muslim terrorist countries that are responsible for 9/11. Saudi Arabia is responsible for 9/11. So the Saudi ambassador's wife gave the money to the 9/11 terrorists to carry out the attack. The Saudi regime had television programs where they were praising the 19 terrorists who carried out the 9/11 attack and calling them the Magnificent 19. And the United States gives trillions of dollars to this monstrous Nazi terrorist country called Saudi Arabia. So this is what you're writing is actually a very realistic illustration of what is going on in the world today. As crazy as it sounds, that's the crazy world we're living in. And we better change, and we better change fast, or we're going to face an unbelievable catastrophe. Thank you, Super Zionist. And now we go to the great Dr. Dan, the voice of reason, common sense, and logic, who writes, and I quote, "How should overcrowding of human populations be controlled or managed as well as prevented?" Unquote. Well, Dr. Dan, I think the only human population that should be controlled are of evil people. I think controlling the Muslim population is a very good idea. The fewer Muslim babies that there are in the world, the better the world is. The better off the world is. But Jews and righteous Gentiles, I don't think, should have population control. Jews and righteous Gentiles should have as many babies as they can possibly have. So I think if we're talking about population control, there should be population control programs in third world countries, among evil people, among Muslims. Yes, because they bring babies into the world, and the result is very bad for the world. But righteous people should have as many babies as possible. Thank you, Dr. Dan. And now we go to the great Gematria, who writes, and I quote, "Chaim Ha'amitz, I have an uncle who recently wore a shirt that said, 'Free Mumia Jamal. What should I say to this uncle?'" Unquote. Whoa. He wants to free a black Muslim Jew hater and racist who was a member of the Black Panther Party, an organization, a terrorist organization that wants to exterminate the Jewish people. And he, as a Jew, is wearing shirts calling for freeing this black Muslim who murdered a police officer and who wants to murder him and his whole family and cut his throat? I mean, Mumia Jamal, Abu Mumia Jamal, whatever his name is, and all of these other beasts, again, would kill your uncle in 2 seconds, and kill his family in 2 seconds, and enjoy every minute of killing them, God forbid, and would murder every single Jew in the world and every single white person in the world if they could, and every non-Muslim in the world if they could. And he's wearing the shirt to free this monster? It's beyond human understanding, Gematria. Beyond human comprehension. What else can I say? Anyway, I hope your uncle has a speedy recovery, because he definitely has a serious problem. Thank you, Gematria. And now we go to our friend Eli Yitzchaki, who is also active on the Hebrew Forum, who writes, and I quote, "Hi Chaim, how much can you credit Shimon Peres with giving Israel the atom bomb?" Unquote. I give Shimon Peres zero credit on every issue, in every subject. He's a murderer of Jews, not just because of the Oslo agreements. He's trying to destroy Israel, and he is not responsible for Israel getting the atomic bomb. Jewish scientists and with Jewish brains got Israel the atomic bomb. Shimon Peres is not a scientist. He claims that he got certain technology from France, which helped Israel develop the atomic bomb. Please. Jewish brains are what got Israel the atomic bomb. France would not have transferred to Israel the technology that you need to develop atomic bombs, even though the Jews always want to give credit to everybody, all their enemies and everybody else. They always want to do this. Jews love doing this. But Shimon Peres is a liar. He is not responsible for Israel getting the atomic bomb. And Shimon Peres wanted to give nuclear reactors to Iran. He proposed giving nuclear reactors to Iran. We've exposed this in the past. If it were up to Shimon Peres, the Iranian Nazi terrorist regime would have nuclear bombs for many years now. And who knows, there might have been a nuclear holocaust by now, God forbid. That's Shimon Peres, the traitor. And now Eli Yitzchaki also writes, and how do you think the Messianic Jews should be treated, unquote. Well, any Jew that leaves the Jewish faith and joins this type of cult is a traitor to the Jewish people. They're traitors, and they should be treated like traitors. The way the halakha and the Torah command that traitors should be treated, that's how they should be treated. We have prayers that clearly describe what should happen to them, to the minim velaminim vehamalshinim. We have prayers on that. Three times a day we pray for their destruction. And that's what we're supposed to, because they're minim under Jewish law. And that's what we're supposed to pray for, and that is how they should be treated. Anyway, thank you, Eli. And now we go to Waiting for the Mother Plane to Come, who is our great JTFer. And he writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, how long until we have a Friday night history, quote-unquote, special on network TV explaining how Moses, David, Jesus, the apostles, etc. were Arabs, unquote. Oh, no, you know, it's not going to take a long time for that to happen. I assume something like that will eventually happen. Yeah. Either they're already saying they were black. You know, we already have them saying they were black. You have white people. You have this sick, evil, ugly white woman on ZooTube who did a video explaining how the black Hebrews are right. I mean, it's unbelievable. The black Hebrews say that she's a devil and that all whites are devils. And you got a white woman doing a video saying, yes, the black Hebrews are right. I mean, it's absolutely beyond belief. It's absolutely beyond belief. You know, the Arabs teach in the Arab world that Shakespeare, one of the things they were teaching was that William Shakespeare was an Arab. Why? Shakespeare comes from the word sheik, they were saying. Comes from the word sheik. That he was really an Arab. Can you imagine an Arab in England? Hundreds of years ago, an Arab in England writing the way Shakespeare wrote? And, you know, these people are completely insane. They live in a complete fantasy world. But in the end, self-hating whites, self-hating Jews, self-hating Americans and Westerners adopt all of their insanity, adopt all of their lies and all of their insanity. I mean, this really happens. These things are really happening. Thank you, Waiting for the Mother Plane. And now we go to the great Tag Mechir Tzedek, who writes, and I quote, should a drone strike that hideous witch from Chechnya, the one who gave birth to the two terrorist brothers, unquote. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, she's a terrorist herself, and absolutely. And Tag Mechir writes, too, update on Israel and the movement, unquote. Okay. Well, as you know, Tag Mechir, our movement in Israel is focused right now on waking people up with two goals. Number one, to build a big opposition, a physical opposition that will exist to any expulsion of Jews and to the creation of a Palestine state. We want to make sure that Jews will physically, with their bodies, block the expulsion of Jews, the destruction of Jewish communities, and the creation of a so-called Palestine state. So that's the first thing that we preach, and that's what we're trying to encourage in Israel. And if our, by the way, if our movement were not there saying this, no one else is saying this on a consistent basis. No one. No one is speaking about it. No one gives this type of message. We are the only ones giving this type of message on a consistent basis. So that's very important. And we encourage, of course, we are getting other people. We encourage other people who then agree with what we're saying, but they by themselves wouldn't say it the way we're saying it. So we're trying to educate people, and we're trying to wake people up through our videos, through our forum, through Facebook, through other means. We're trying to wake people up and make sure that the young Jews, especially in Judea and Samaria, recognize that the only way they're going to save not only Judea and Samaria, not only their homes and their communities, but the whole Jewish people from the catastrophe, from the suicidal catastrophe of a Palestine state, the only way that they're going to be able to do this is if they physically are prepared to block with their bodies the creation of a so-called Palestine state. Of course, there are no Palestinians. There is no Palestine. It's a complete lie and a bluff. And the creation of a so-called Palestine state would be suicidal for Israel. That's the first thing we want to, that we're trying to wake people up and convince them that the only way to stop it is through massive civil disobedience and people with their bodies on a massive scale blocking the Israeli army and the Israeli police from throwing people out of their homes and destroying their homes. That's number one. The second thing is we want to create a new political movement eventually for elections. Now, that's going to take time. That's not going to be easy because the reason it's going to take time and it's not going to be easy is because we don't have money. I mean, our budget is very limited. But we want to create a political movement that will be big enough and strong enough to be able to go into the elections and to be able to get Knesset representation. That's the second thing we're pushing for. And so we're trying to educate people and wake people up with that. And that's why, you know, we've put out, as you may have seen on the forum, we continue to put out hundreds of Hebrew videos with our message, our essential message that no one else is willing to give to the people of Israel. And we continue with our Hebrew message on Facebook and with our forum and with every other means that we could possibly come up with considering our limited budget. But we're doing the best we can under the circumstances. And you know, we do wake certain people up, and we certainly give people who we do reach, the people that we do reach, we give them something to think about. So that's what we're doing right now. And God willing, I hope that we're able to do much more. Thank you, Tag Mechir. And now we go to our friend Maimonides, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, what is your assessment on the current civil war in Syria and the claims that Assad used chemical weapons, unquote. Well, of course Assad has used chemical weapons. And if the anti-Assad terrorists in Syria had chemical weapons, they would have used it also. Of course, that Arab Muslim Nazis will use any means available. They will exterminate their own people. They'll exterminate their own women and children. These are beasts. These are barbarians. Now, my concern is I hope that the United States does not get involved and allows this civil war to continue, because this civil war is good. It's good that they're doing what they're doing. Better that they kill each other than murder us. So I want the civil war to continue. I want it to continue. Now, do we have to keep our eye on chemical weapons and make sure that none of them get into the hands of Hezbollah, for instance, who are allies of Assad? Of course, we do have to keep our eye on these things. We should be concerned about this. But remember, if Assad is overthrown, you're going to get an Islamic terrorist regime in Syria. The people who replace him are also going to be a bunch of Islamic terrorists. And they are actually connected to Al-Qaeda. And they're going to get their hands on whatever chemical weapons Syria has. Anyway, thank you, Maimonides. And now we go to the great Ruby Stars, who writes, and I quote, in your opinion, why is Homeland Security buying so many hollow point bullets and weapons, unquote? Great question as always, Ruby Stars. This is just another example of the evil people that we have in this administration, in the Obama administration, and in Washington. What evil people, what traitors to the United States they are. They are spending double on hollow point bullets and weapons. It costs twice as much and there is no need for it. They're buying, for instance, 1.6 billion rounds of this type of ammunition over the next 5 years. 1.6 billion rounds. So we're talking about large sums of money. And it's costing, again, it doubles the cost. Most of this ammunition is going to be used in training, just for training people. I mean, they're going to, for training people, you don't need hollow point bullets and weapons. What are you using hollow point bullets and weapons for purposes of training? There is no benefit to that. None. It's a complete waste of money. And the reason they want to do this, and they're doing it intentionally, the reason they want to do, I really believe that. They want to spend money on these things because they don't want, they want to say, well, we don't have money for customs and border protection. And they're cutting back on customs and border protection. That they're cutting back on. They have plenty of money to waste on bullets that cost twice as much and that there's no reason why they should be buying the more expensive bullets. That they have plenty of money to waste for that. But to have customs and border protection security so that we have fewer illegal aliens sneaking into the United States, for that they claim they don't have money and they're making deep cuts when it comes to customs and border security protection. So this is, you know, they want as many illegals to come into this country as possible and want to legalize them and make them citizens as quickly as possible because they want America to become a third world banana republic and because they know that these illegals are going to vote Democrat. That's what they want. Now, I understand that Obama and the Democrats want this. They know that these are going to be Democrats. They're going to help them create an eternal Democrat majority in the United States, and America will always be have a socialist majority if these illegals come in and become citizens. I understand Obama and the Democrats wanting to do that because that's their evil agenda. But Republicans also want to give citizenship to the illegals. That's the incredible thing. Republicans like Rand Paul and Marco Rubio also support giving citizenship to the illegal aliens. That is true insanity. That is true insanity. But I believe that the fact that they're wasting so much money on these bullets, I think, is connected to their desire to prevent America from having any type of real border security so that they can make deep cuts in other areas. Anyway, thank you, Ruby Stars, and now we go to our friend 112, who writes, and I quote, "Does Judaism teach anything like meditation through body awareness, focusing on feeling?" Unquote. The Breslev Hasidim, who are good Jews, they believe in meditation, but not meditation in the sense of the Far East, the way they do it in the Far East with Far East mystical religions. No. Judaism does not believe in just clearing your mind and thinking about nothing. I mean, what's the point of being in this world if you're just going to clear your mind and think about nothing? No. Judaism believes if certain segments, there are certain groups within the Jewish faith that are good Jews, like the Breslev Hasidim, who believe in meditating about Jewish subjects. In other words, thinking about God and God's existence and Jewish subjects and why we're in this world and what God, in other words, take some time during the day and think about God and think about the Torah and think about why we're in this world and think about our existence and our purpose in life. Take some time to think about these things. That is something the Breslev Hasidim and the Breslav Rebbe have urged people to do. And I think that there is some, I think that there may be something to that. That may be helpful for certain people. But just meditating and clearing your mind of everything, no. The only time you should clear your mind of all thoughts, before you go to sleep. Before you go to sleep, clear your mind of all thoughts so you'll be able to sleep. You know, if thinking of certain thoughts prevents you from sleeping well, then clear your mind of all thoughts so you can sleep well during the night. But when you're awake during the day, you should always be thinking and always be using your mind. Always use your mind to better yourself and to make the world a better place. And now 112 writes, and I quote, "Can unmarried people become president?" Unquote. I don't see why not. Marriage is certainly a good thing, and people should be encouraged to become married. People should be encouraged to People should be encouraged to have families and to be married. But I think an unmarried person can become president. Yeah, I think so. I think probably yes. In Israel, there's a question about kings, whether a king can be unmarried. That there's a serious question about, because, you know, the be fruitful and multiply and having children is a commandment. So, you know, of course, the only way to have children is through marriage. The only way you're supposed to have children, the proper way, is if you're married. So in Israel, when we restore the monarchy in Israel someday and have the Messianic era, the king will probably have to be married and have children. Anyway, thank you, 112. And I want to thank all of our great JTFers for another program that I very much enjoyed doing. Until next week, Shalom.